Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
It's so nice to be here tonight, and it's so exciting for me to be here in the new store at Tattered Cover Aspen Grove, which I've never been to before. So I'm delighted to see that it feels just like a Tattered Cover should. It has the nice green carpet and the same bookshelves that we know and love. It's really exciting to see everybody at the Tattered Cover open up a new store. It's really, really thrilling. Okay, I thought that tonight I would describe what I was trying to accomplish in this book, tell you a little bit about the paperback and how it's different, because there's new material there, and then read from the beginning of the book. So I think I've learned a lot, even since this book came out, about this subject. So I feel more equipped to talk about it even today than I did when the hardback first came out. And I'll say a little bit more about that, too. When I was first starting out on this project, I'm not your typical person to write a book about the military. I lean to the left liberal side of the political spectrum. I did not grow up in a military family. I have had no personal experience of military service. And our country is really divided, I think, between those who have experience of military service and those who don't, and those who understand it and those who don't. And I really fell into the camp of those who didn't understand and didn't know firsthand what that was all about. And I really wanted to understand more. And I could tell that there was something really wrong with a decade of conflict and many people going off on deployments and a whole bunch of people at home not really understanding what they were living through. And I wanted to see if I could write something that would illuminate more of what the struggle is for those who didn't understand, like me. And I also had this one particular question in my mind, which was, why is it that some veterans really struggle to come back home? And for a civilian person, that seems kind of paradoxical. Once you get back home, it should be great. You know, you're out of danger. You're safe now. You're back here where you belong, and everything should be fine. And sometimes it just isn't. Sometimes it can take a really long time. And that's in particular what I wanted to look at. And when I started interviewing different veterans, I was talking to men and women, different people. So I didn't actually set out to write a book about women in the military necessarily. It was just that when I went in asking that sort of a question, women opened up to me. And some of the men I interviewed, really not so much. I probably wasn't the right person, I don't think, for them. And these particular women opened up to me a lot. And they definitely had big struggles. And one of the women, the three women in the book are really different from one another in some ways. All three women served in the Indiana National Guard. And so this is really a story about soldiers in the Guard, not the active duty branches. All three women joined before 9/11, and so never really meant to sign up for full-time deployments, never really envisioned that, and were caught off guard or, you know, were surprised by that after 9/11. But other than that, they're really different from one another. There's 30 years difference in age from the youngest to the oldest, and there's that much difference in their political beliefs. There's that much difference in their feelings about military service and what it meant to go on the deployments. They really, really, really did not agree on who to vote for in 2000, whether it was a good thing for us to go into Afghanistan, whether it was a good thing for us to go into Iraq. They had big disagreements among themselves about those things. And yet, On their deployments, they became so close that today they would say they're more of a family than their own family. And in many ways, that's the book that I wound up writing. It was really the story of how those relationships got forged and what those friendships were like. There's a lot of other books written about Iraq and Afghanistan and other books written about women in the military. And some of them maybe conform more to the traditional idea of a book about the military. There's a book out recently called Ashley's War, which is really a book about women at the cutting edge of what's happening in the military, women at the forefront of how the jobs are changing, doing things that women have never done in previous conflicts. So that's an excellent book if that's what you're looking for. My book is a little different. It's not like a recruiting brochure. It's kind of gritty, very realistic. These women are having trouble when they're getting home. One of them has PTSD and a mild traumatic brain injury. She's struggling to parent her three kids. She's a single mom who did two deployments. You know, it's not the airbrushed version of things. And for some people, it's not the right book. For some people, that's not really what they want. To me, I feel that the three women that I wrote about are incredibly heroic. But to really understand them and sympathize with them, I sort of had to know what their struggle was. And it was hard. So it's kind of a hard book in parts, I think. One of the women turned over all of her medical records and all of her therapy notes because she was really, really having trouble letting go of living through an IED blast. And she really, really opened up about how hard that was for her to let go of and how guilty she felt for driving the truck that got close enough to the bomb and being the person who turned the wheel and then triggered the bomb blast. In her mind, she felt responsible for everybody in the truck and all of their injuries, and she just couldn't let go of a sense of responsibility for that. And that was, you know, because I had that question in my mind at the beginning, why do some people struggle when they get home? She was then the right person for me to write about, and that her story felt like the right story for me to tell. And she's a really interesting person because she's had a hard life. You know, she grew up partly in foster care. She dropped out of high school. She had a son when she was only 17. Then she got married and had two more kids, but got a divorce. So a single mom with three kids who had signed up really just to be in the National Guard, who wound up getting sent on 2-year-long deployments. And the effect on her kids also was something I ended up really, really wanting to understand. What happens to kids who are put in that situation? So that's kind of an overview of the book and what it's about, what I was trying to tackle. The bigger thing, though, that I think maybe was, I hope I accomplished, was just reminding people that there are women in uniform. It's still this very foreign idea to some people, even some people in the military. And women veterans, when they come home, sometimes when they're at gatherings or events, there'll be a lot of people in the room, maybe most of them men, and somebody will come up to them and they'll wonder who they're married to, because they can't, the person asking the question can't imagine that the woman is the veteran. So women coming home are running into things like that all the time. We're still getting used to the idea that women are serving in large numbers, larger numbers than ever before. And when they come home, even some of the women themselves, they're not identifying themselves as veterans. They'll show up in a setting and they'll talk about themselves. They won't mention that. They'll show up for healthcare. And a third of women veterans will show up in a healthcare setting and not identify as a veteran. Now, they might have a bunch of health issues that are actually related to their experiences in the military, say things that happened overseas. And the healthcare provider won't actually know to that may not understand them fully if they're not explaining themselves fully. But this idea that women can be soldiers, somehow very foreign. You know, we still have this idea that we send men off to fight and they're supposed to protect women at home. This is like hardwired somewhere. It's very, very basic. And the whole concept of women putting on a uniform and serving is, it's almost like we can't accept it. And even some of the women who've had that experience then sometimes are not describing themselves that way when they get home. And one of the women that I wrote about was like that when she came back. She didn't identify herself as a veteran. She just pretended it hadn't happened, which is kind of strange to think about, you know, sort of interesting, but very real for as many as a quarter or a third of women returning. In the next 5 years, we've got 1 million people who are going to be transitioning out of military roles into civilian society, becoming veterans. And I think it's just a really big job for all of us to take on, to welcome them back, understand what they've been through, know their stories, and really embrace them. Because they don't always feel that they're welcome back in that way. So for me, part of the attempt to do that was trying to write about these three women and their particular struggles and their particular stories. So the paperback, which just came out, has an update. So some people might have read the hardback. I'm not sure if there's anybody here who did. But if you did, there's new material in the paperback that kind of brings the story full circle. Tell your friends in book groups. that's exciting. Let me read a little bit. And then I would really love to take questions and have more of a dialogue. So I'm gonna read from the beginning of the book where you meet kind of the woman who's the main character at the beginning, and then I'll explain when I'm done how she gets to know the other two women in the book. Michelle Fisher had not yet reached 20, but she already knew how to find the National Guard Armory, a low-slung, modern-looking building made of red bricks with a green metal roof. The recruiters who worked there had established many ways of meeting young people, and Michelle had swayed to pop music inside the vast blue gymnasium there at both her junior and her senior prom. She did not have the nerve to return and talk to the recruiters on her own, however, which is why she had badgered her boyfriend of 6 months into accompanying her. It was March 2001, and Michelle was 18 years old. From her vantage point, the Indiana Army National Guard looked like the answer to a dilemma, which was that she found her circumstances dreary. Michelle had thrust through a childhood full of neglect, making her both headstrong and vulnerable, and it was no accident that she had dreamed up the idea to enlist, but required Noah Jarvis's steadying company to execute it. That was Michelle, audacious, needy, a little bit self-absorbed. Michelle was quite certain she knew what the guard would ask of them in return, 1 weekend a month, 2 weeks every summer. Maybe they would also be asked to hem a swollen river with sandbags, or gather up the pieces of a town shattered by a tornado. She thought that was a price she might be willing to pay in exchange for the prospect of leaving home. Michelle had spent her entire childhood in southern Indiana, mostly in and around Evansville, an industrial city tucked into a bend in the Ohio River. The rest of the Midwest had forgotten about Evansville so long ago it might as well have been southern, and the pace of life was slow. Vast barges heaped with black coal sank low onto the river, crawling past casino boats where people went to hazard their earnings. Michelle's father lived on the opposite shore, buried deep in the woods of Kentucky, in an air-conditioned trailer where he hoarded mementos and told unlikely stories. Everybody Michelle knew seemed bled of hope. She had grown up watching businesses shutter and jobs disappear and her mother slip into poverty and her siblings enthrall themselves with drugs. 10 months earlier, in the spring of 2000, when she'd graduated from Evansville Central High, the theme of her commencement had been, "Oh, the places you'll go." So far, however, she had gone nowhere, and the year since she had finished high school had been dispiriting. She had set her sights on going to Indiana University, one of the most prestigious colleges in the state. Nobody else in her family had ever been to college, however, and Michelle did not know how to find the path that led to a fancy campus. In the fall of 2000, she had enrolled instead at the University of Southern Indiana, a commuter college beside another part of the Lloyd Expressway, just to the west of the Armory. She'd borrowed the maximum possible amount in student loans as she was paying her entire tuition bill by herself. As she began her college career, Michelle was sharing a one-bedroom apartment with her mother, working as a waitress at a steakhouse called the Golden Corral, and driving back and forth to classes in the tank. That's what she named her 1994 Silver Ford Tempo. It had been a gift from her father. A burly wreck of a man, he loved Michelle dearly, but he had never stuck with any of his four wives, nor had he safeguarded the economic well-being of his children. He had bought the car used for $2,000 and had given it to Michelle in lieu of paying the $40,000 in child support that he owed to her mother. Michelle's mother eked out a thin existence with occasional welfare checks, irregular jobs, regular packs of Marlboro Lights, and a steady supply of double cola. After he bought the car for Michelle, her father had made her mother sign a letter saying she wouldn't sue him for the rest of the money that he owed, and then he'd handed Michelle the keys. She liked to joke she drove a $40,000 beater. The joke encapsulated everything about her childhood, what she'd been given, what her parents had failed to provide, and the spark that let her laugh about it all, especially the parts that were not really funny. Michelle had spent the winter of 2000 in the tank, driving to and from classes, her job, college parties, and the one-bedroom apartment she shared with her mom. She smoked too much pot, went to too many keg parties, and started dropping acid. In the spring of 2001, she learned that her standing at the University of Southern Indiana honors program had been thrown into jeopardy because she'd been failing to show up for an algebra class that was held at 9 in the morning. Somehow, she had taken a wrong turn. She knew where this road led because she had watched various older siblings take it. You started off drinking too much, and then you wound up battling a lifetime of addiction. Michelle wanted to leave all this behind. She wanted to stride across a pretty campus. She wanted to be assigned a room in a dormitory. She wanted to take classes that were challenging. Yet she couldn't calculate how to pay for her aspirations until she remembered the military recruiters who had visited the economics class she had taken during her senior year at Central High. They had handed out fake dog tags and spoken of true heroism. One recruiter had said the National Guard would send students to any college in the state free of charge. Many of Michelle's fellow students had accepted the offer, which struck them as low risk. The country had been at peace for more than a decade, and the only serious conflict that had occurred in their lifetimes was the Persian Gulf War, which had been wrapped up in a few months. Plus, everybody in southern Indiana knew that the National Guard didn't go to war. If you wanted to see combat, you joined the regular army. Michelle hadn't pursued the matter because she didn't see herself as the military type. She thought of herself as a music-loving, pot-smoking, left-leaning hippie, not a soldier. By the spring of 2001, however, after almost a full year of driving the tank back and forth to the campus of her commuter college, she found herself recalling the pitch made by the recruiters. She told her boyfriend Noah that she was thinking about signing up and hinted he should enlist too. Noah confessed he found the idea intimidating. He wasn't in good shape, he said. He wasn't sure if he would measure up as a soldier. But Noah was besotted with Michelle and thought it would not be chivalrous to send his girlfriend off to talk to the recruiters alone. It had been a grim and frigid spring. On a gray day with the temperature stuck down in the 30s, Michelle and Noah drove to the Armory in Noah's Chevy Astro van. They pushed through the Armory's double glass front doors and turned right down the main hallway. Inside the recruiter's office, a height and weight chart hung on the wall and posters urged, "Be all you can be." There were two desks. Behind one sat a middle-aged black man in a uniform, a sergeant first class, and his name was Wilbur A. Granderson. Michelle sat down in one of the two chairs facing him, and Noah sat down in the other. Michelle announced they might enlist, but first they had some questions. Was it really true the guard could give them a free ride to college? Granderson confirmed the guard would pay 100% of their tuition at any institution if they signed up for 6 years of regular guard duty plus 2 years in the reserves. While in the reserves, they'd no longer go to drill, but they could be called on in an emergency. That was it. An 8-year commitment. In return, he could offer full tuition, a housing allowance of $220 a month, and a kicker bonus of an additional $200 for each month they spent in school. Plus, he would throw in a one-time enlistment bonus of $8,000. And the guard would pay off any existing student loans. It was a lot of money. Michelle wanted to make sure she understood the whole deal. What if she failed to make it to drill one weekend? She could make up the time, Granderson told her. What if she wanted to study abroad? No problem. She could just add on an extra semester of drill time after she got back. The recruiter turned to Noah. What was on his mind? Noah wanted to know if a misdemeanor charge for possession of marijuana would be an issue. He could still sign up, Granderson replied, but first a specified amount of time had to elapse. That was the extent of their questions. So as a reader, I think you're reading this, of course, after 9/11, and you're looking over their shoulder, and you know later they're going to wish they had a few more questions, but they didn't know at that point in time to ask anything else, and they went ahead and signed up. One of the amazing things, I think, is that Michelle, who really probably would not have enlisted after 9/11, becomes very close friends with Debbie, who's 30 years older than she is, who would have enlisted after 9/11 in a heartbeat. And they help one another through their deployment. And I think it's those kinds of bridges that really interest me, that you know, these friends are going to help them help one another get through this experience of doing a year-long deployment in a war zone and then figuring out how to come back home. So I'm going to stop there and open it up for questions. Yeah.
How did you get connected with these girls?
How did I get connected with these women? So I started off at the VA, meeting with some people who worked there, and they very kindly pointed out to me that they were not going to introduce journalists and veterans that they were providing care for, but it, you know, suggested maybe I should try the VFW, and I got to know the folks that ran VFW Post 1. I didn't even know that we had Post 1 here, the first one ever, which I thought was amazing. And there's, you know, great people at the VFW. They're incredible. So I started there, and they introduced me to a number of veterans. I interviewed about a dozen people. And as I was doing that, I was simultaneously taking a writing class with a friend of mine named Lisa Jones, who's an amazing writing instructor. And just coincidentally, in that writing class, there was a woman who said, "Well, I know a veteran you should talk to, and that's Michelle." So it was a very sort of funny roundabout thing, meeting Michelle. As soon as I met her, I thought, wow, well, I can totally identify with her. I mean, I could have been that kid in a heartbeat. That could have been me. I would have been looking for college tuition. I probably would have thought of enlisting, you know. So she was a way in for me. And then she introduced me to Desma, who's the single mom with three children that I mentioned. And Desma really steals the show in the book. I think when she first shows up in the book as a reader, you're kind of wondering, Is she going to lead Michelle astray, or should Michelle be friends with this woman? You know, Desma is acting out and misbehaving and getting in trouble. And then as time goes on, I think, and you get to know Desma better as a reader and see her do a second deployment and realize like how heroic she is and what an amazing person she is. I think Desma sort of steals the show in the book. And Debbie in a whole different way does too. But Michelle introduced me to Debbie and to Desma. Yeah.
Did you feel like your three women were pretty typical or very unusual?
This is a great question. Did I feel that the three women I chose to write about were typical or unusual? So I think the strength and the weakness of the kind of work that I do is that I tell individual stories. And this is always the question, can they really represent a group as a whole? So there are many ways in which these three women are not typical and don't represent women in the military as a whole. For one thing, they're in the Guard, they're not in the active duty branches. So that's one difference between, say, some other women. A second thing, these three women are enlisted. There are many women who are officers. They would be a totally different story. These three women are in support roles. Women are moving closer and closer into combat roles, and some are in situations we would think of as combat. I didn't write about that. So these women are in safer jobs until the day comes when Desma is assigned to drive a truck on the highways of Iraq, which is not what she trained to do, but that's what the Army needed. Then she's in a much more dangerous position. Here's the ways I think they are typical. Over the last decade, you saw many more women serving, and many of those women did get assigned to jobs that were more dangerous, like driving trucks on the highway of Iraq, than women had previously been assigned to do. So in that way, I think Desma's experience is actually very typical of, say, what happened to women as a whole serving in these two conflicts. She represents women moving closer to danger. That's generally what was happening. Another way that these women are and are not typical is around children. So you have Michelle, who's a college student with no kids, Desma, who's a single mom with three children, and Debbie, who becomes a grandmother while they're in Iraq. She's 52, I think, on that deployment, 56 on the second deployment. That age range represents kind of the full, you know, generational span of women in the military. And one out of three, it's not one out of three women in the military that has children, but so 16%, I think, of women in the reserves are single moms with kids. So Desma's story, it's not typical, but I think it's really important to understand. We did not, as a country, used to deploy single moms. This is a new thing. They are and are not typical. All three women are white. You know, the military is a very diverse environment. So they don't represent the full spectrum of what you're going to see in the military. Another way I would say that they may not be entirely typical is that they're breaking the rules a lot. I think sometimes there are women who've served in the military who read this book and say, I know women exactly like that. I know these women. And there are other women in the military who read this book and say, I would never have behaved that way. And I'm offended, you know, that you're writing about women who made those choices. I wouldn't have made those choices. So, you know, different responses from it. The military is a very rule-oriented environment. And the women I chose to write about are not always following those rules. Well, so your question is that a function of coming from the guard as opposed to, I might offend people in the guard if I said that might be true. But I do think that people in the guard are toggling back and forth between the civilian world and the military world. And so it's just a different mentality, more of a hybrid culture than the pure military culture. I think you see many guard units that are very rule oriented, though. So maybe I'm not fully qualified even to, I didn't write about the active duty branches, so I'm probably not the expert who could say how the guard differs from active duty exactly. Yeah. Yes, yeah. So the question is, I think the way the question was framed was, in Just Like Us, I felt disappointed by someone who didn't go on to reach her full potential or achieve things that I thought she should. And did I feel that way about these women?
It was more, yeah, I guess that's good.
So tell me if I... I'll try and answer the question I think you asked. No. And I would say, I think you're talking about a moment in Just Like Us where one of the young women has just finished college and accidentally gets pregnant. And and that I was expressing concern for her that it was now going to be hard for her to go to law school as she had wanted to do and become a lawyer. And I was wondering how she was going to juggle motherhood and possibly being a single mom with achieving the career that she had just gotten a college degree to maybe achieve. But I don't know if I would say I was disappointed in her. I would say I was afraid for her, concerned for her maybe. And, I was really rooting for her, and she actually has done great and been an amazing mom. And I still see the women in Just Like Us on a regular basis. And I'm so impressed. I just have to sort of say, I guess, that I'm so impressed with what kind of a mom she is. And she's doing really fulfilling work at the same time. So I today have no disappointment whatsoever there. I really identify with the women in this book a lot. I know their experiences are different than mine, and I think their childhoods were harder than mine was. But I grew up not knowing exactly how to pay for college. I didn't have the same financial predicament that Michelle did. But my college tuition, was hard to come by. And I struggled to fit in the college environment because my background wasn't as privileged as others around me. And so Michelle's life is an order of difficulty, or two or three, harder than mine, but her struggle is something I really, really, really admire. And so again, I think I'm sort of rooting for Michelle in this scene. I'm trying to describe, I'm sort of channeling Michelle. I mean, these are in some cases, like, there's not quotes around some of this stuff. It's like, it's my words, but in a lot of those moments, I'm actually directly choosing words that she used to describe her surroundings from interviews. So this is a mixture of how she sees the environment she came from and how I see it. When she speaks about her circumstances that she was trying to get out of, she's pretty critical. And so I think some of that probably came across in what I read, and maybe you're picking up on that. But what I admire about her is she wants to battle against it. She wants to she understands addiction. She's been surrounded by it. She wants to avoid it. She understands dysfunction firsthand. She wants to sort of escape it. You know, later at a certain point, Michelle took me to meet her dad, and the trailer that he lives in is next to another trailer, and the second trailer he calls his party trailer. And if you go there at 10 in the morning, he's going to offer you a beer. And in the party trailer, where he let a friend of his make meth, you know, who knows what has happened? And he's been charged with that crime, so I can say that he did that. And I had to go get the court documents to prove that. But, you know, Michelle is looking at that environment, and I'm looking in that environment saying, that's not a great environment. And yet, Michelle is really trying to figure out, how do you love your dad, write letters to him all the time when you're on a deployment, and get the heck out of there? At the same time, it's complicated, but it's not, I don't feel disappointment in them at all. Much more something like admiration, really. It's a struggle. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. It does. okay, the question is, I'm going to paraphrase and tell me if I get it right. The question is, if I do really deep reporting and spend years getting to know people, how do I keep boundaries? And I think implicit in your question is, do I stay a journalist, or does it morph into something else? Because I know you were mentioning, you assume I don't offer counseling or advice, or so let me try to answer the question I heard, and then tell me if there's parts of it I didn't get to. So I used to do deadline journalism. You know, I used to write for weekly newspapers and monthly magazines. It has been a totally different thing to write these books, entirely different. I used to, when I did deadline work, you know, parachute into somebody's life, ask a bunch of questions, run away, try to write something. And I don't think I really got to know those people terribly well that I was writing about in the magazine stories by comparison. Now, having done this, it would be really hard to go back to the magazine work, because for me, this is really, really much more fulfilling. I feel that it's very, very hard to know people. I mean, I just think it takes years and years. I've got an editor who's brilliant, who tricks me into stopping reporting and actually writing these books, because I would just go on and on forever. And I have to say that for me, the first book was a little bit easier in terms of understanding the landscape, because truly the military is a more foreign environment for me than Mexican-American immigrant families, even though I'm not Mexican-American, but because I come from an Irish-American, because my parents immigrated to this country from Ireland and I was raised Catholic, there's just many similarities between my cultural background and the backgrounds of these families that I was writing about. Whereas the military environment, it's really, to me, it's more different. I'll give an example. So at one point, Desma was trying to describe where she was living in Iraq. And I said, were you in a tent like in Afghanistan or a bee hut, like those plywood huts, or what was it that you were living in? And she said, oh, it was a CHU. And I was like, sorry, Des, I think that's one of those acronyms. What's a CHU? And she said, oh, it's a containerized housing unit. And I'm like, what's a containerized housing unit? She said, it's a Connex. And I was like, what's a Connex? She said, you know, it's a shipping container, the metal things you see on the backs of a truck or, you know, on a train. We lived in those. So, I mean, it wasn't just one act of translation. There were like four stages in her translating for me, just the name of the object in which she lived. She spoke a totally different language. You know, I understand that the families that these girls lived in, they spoke Spanish at home, but with me, they were speaking English and we understood. I didn't have to ask them to translate, honestly, as much as I did these three women in the military. They had to translate for me all the time. It's like astonishing how separate the military culture is. And if you don't know the language, you're just, you know, at a loss. Again, I think it takes years and years for me to know these three individuals, understand the cultural environment that they're living in, that's new to me, that, you know, where I'm trying to sort of see my way. And then just to feel that I have enough authority to kind of write their story, it takes just a really, really, really long time. And there are many, many, many interviews. And then I was asking them if they could share. They shared diaries and letters and the medical records that Desma had. And at the end of it all, honestly, I still wasn't sure that I had gotten it right. And so one of the boundaries I decided to cross really purposefully was to ask them to vet the manuscript, you know, to look at it before it went to publication, because I didn't know if this was really a story that was told the right way, that they would feel proud of, that that I'd gotten all the facts right. And it was very, very, very valuable for me to get their feedback. Technically, you're not supposed to do that as a journalist. I actually had to go to my publisher, ask for permission. I had to have a conversation with an attorney. I had to get written emails, basically. I had to get something in writing from the women acknowledging that I was giving them the manuscript, but I had not agreed to give them veto power, that, you know, I still had authorial control. It was sort of complicated because as a journalist, you're not supposed to, like, cross that boundary. It's one of those lines in journalism they teach you not to cross. But I think when you do these stories that are really intimate, that take a long time, you're kind of honor bound then to, I think, share the manuscript before publication and just make sure it's okay. And in each case, there was something that felt too personal that they asked me to take out, which I took out. So I think what I'm saying is to to do this sort of a book, I feel you have to shift the boundaries a little bit and actually collaborate a little bit more and double check, is this okay? Really have informed consent, not just somebody at the beginning saying, sure, I'll write a book. I'll work on a book with you. But at the end say, and how do you feel about this book? To me, that feels important. But I've been a journalist my whole life. And so I think it's second nature to me to not cross over into the role of counselor. If they ask my advice, I'll tell them. But it's not where I go. I think in asking questions, sometimes I might get them to think about things that I'm asking about. But the aim is different. You know, it's not the same thing as therapy at all. And I would never confuse that. I hope they wouldn't confuse that. I do think that they really wanted to tell their stories and that there was something very powerful about telling their stories. And Desma, when Desma first came home, so Desma got back from Iraq in 2009. I met her in 2010. At that point in time, she was still in pretty rough shape, and she was like chain smoking. You know, we would sit down to do an interview. She'd last 5-10 minutes, want to go outside, smoke a cigarette. You know, I didn't want to do interviews for too long. She was just not really yet. Her memory was kind of fragmented. She was not in great shape. She was sort of saying, describing something that took place in 2008, but then jumping back to 2004. Her stories were a little jumbled. For her, she found it incredible that she could do interviews with me, everything jumbled up, hand me her military record, hand me her VA file, hand me her therapy notes, and that I could write anything coherent, because she couldn't tell the story in a coherent way. And she really wanted help doing that. And now she goes and talks at the VA, and she's emerging into kind of an advocate. She talks to people on the Senate Armed Services Committee. They call her and ask her, you know, thoughts about things. So I think she somehow in this process, separate from me, she has found her voice to talk about some of this stuff in a pretty powerful way. Did that answer that question? Okay. Yes.
In this age of heightened political correctness that we seem to be suffering through, is there a significance, or what thought did you have with the title Soldier Girls?
Oh, yeah.
Soldier Women?
Right. I'm glad you're asking this. The question's about the title Soldier Girls, and might it not have been Soldier Women, or did I think about that? I thought about this title a lot, maybe too much. So the title comes from a recruiting T-shirt that the National Guard was using during these years when the women were in service. And it was in the height of the conflict when both wars were going full tilt and we had the largest number of people over there, and the war in Iraq had gotten especially violent. It was very, very, very hard for all branches of the military to meet their recruitment quotas. So they were offering much higher bonuses, even than the one described at the beginning of the book, much higher cash bonuses, and also swag. So they were offering free hunting permits, free state park permits, and pink T-shirts that said Soldier Girl on them. So that just struck me. And I liked the resonance of the song Soldier Boy and the term Soldier Girl. And there are two words, soldier and girl, that you kind of think don't belong together. So I thought, okay, I like that. And I'd not come up with other great options. And then my publisher basically asked the same question that you did. Well, is girls Is the word girls demeaning? You know, are you not sort of showing them respect? And I kind of explained where I'd gotten it from. And we said, oh, well, if we put that in the front of the book, you know, where it's the first thing you see, then people will understand that the titles are referenced to that. Yeah, they would if they opened the book up. Actually, what's happened is I think some people are put off, especially women in the military, especially officers. So actually, I think we might have done ourselves a disservice with the title in the way that you're kind of imagining. Live and learn. Yeah. The question is, did the guard honor everything they were going to give Michelle that was described at the beginning of the book and all those promises? Yes, they did. She got every penny, and she went on to use the tuition benefits. It was much harder for her to actually get the tuition benefits. There were so many more forms to fill out. It took so much. The bureaucracy was intense. For all of these women, you see them kind of over time, they have to become very good advocates for themselves to actually like get things that are offered. But when they advocate for themselves well, yes, the military comes through. So she did. And you see Michelle go on to realize her dream of going to Indiana University, which is kind of an amazing thing. And today, if you ask them each how they feel about the fact that they spent these years in the Guard and got these unexpected deployments, you know, Debbie will say it was, bar nothing else, the single most exciting thing she ever did in her life, the most fulfilling experience she's ever had. Desma has a more complicated answer because her children didn't fare well after her second deployment. So she's very, very, very proud of having served as a soldier. And she really feels that she did, especially her second deployment was a very hard one, and that she did a great job. And yet she's still asking herself, would her kids be in better shape if she had not gone? And Michelle, I think, would say, I've heard her say, that her feelings about the military are complicated because she didn't personally support the war in which she served. And so it kind of threw her into a state of internal conflict. But afterwards, the military then paid for her college education and she got many benefits from it. And she comes from a military family and her dad had served and her uncle and her grandfather. So for her, it's a more complicated legacy. She's got a lot of different feelings. She's ambivalent. So a couple more questions. Yes.
Do you think you will keep up with people in both books?
Yes. A while longer? The question is, will I keep up with people in both books? Yes. I feel bonded for life with them. I will keep up with them. Yeah, I do.
You think there were new developments since you wrote the book?
The question is about new developments. So, Debbie's life is actually in many ways similar to how it was at the end of the hardback. Michelle, however, has gone on since the hardback came out. Now, I write about this in the paperback. Michelle decided that she wanted to become an occupational therapist, really because of watching Desma struggle. And so she's in a program right now studying occupational therapy and wants to work with veterans who are returning home. So the whole idea of Michelle starting out as this Ralph Nader voting, pot-smoking, left-leaning person, as she describes herself at the outset of the book, to now somebody who may dedicate her life to working with veterans is such an amazing evolution. And I think to see that come full circle for me was really meaningful. And Desma, I'm sort of giving away the end of the paperback, but Desma finds a program called Veterans to Farmers, and that really helps her. She retires from the military. You see Desma at the end of the hardback.
Thank you.
still putting on the uniform every day to go to a full-time job on an Army post, even though she's in the Guard. And so she's not in the active duty branches of the military, but she's working on an Army post every day. So you see her in the paperback retire, take off the uniform and put it away, and find this program, Veterans to Farmers, and start growing things. And she is much more relaxed now. So you kind of see her evolve further also. Yeah. It's all in an afterword at the very end of the paperback. So the paperback is identical to the hardback, except there's this new material at the very back. Yeah. Okay, thank you very much.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.